This is Audible.
In August 1944, the historic walled city of Saint-Malo, the brightest jewel of the Emerald Coast of Brittany, France, was almost totally destroyed by fire. Of the 865 buildings within the walls, only 182 remained standing and all were damaged to some degree. Philip Beck. It would not have been possible for us to take power or to use it in the ways we have without the radio. Joseph Goebbels.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. Read by Zach Appleman.
Chapter 0. 7 August 1944. Leaflets. At dusk they pour from the sky. They blow across the ramparts, turn cartwheels over rooftops, flutter into ravines between houses. Entire streets swirl with them, flashing white against the cobbles. Urgent message to the inhabitants of this town, they say. Depart immediately to open country. The tide climbs. The moon hangs small and yellow and gibbous. On the rooftops of beachfront hotels to the east, and in the gardens behind them, a half dozen American artillery units drop incendiary rounds into the mouths of mortars. Bombers. They cross the channel at midnight. There are 12 and they are named for songs. Stardust, and Stormy Weather, and In the Mood, and Pistol Packin' Mama. The sea glides along far below, spattered with the countless chevrons of whitecaps. Soon enough the navigators can discern the low moonlit lumps of islands ranged along the horizon. France. Intercoms crackle. Deliberately, almost lazily, the bombers shed altitude. Threads of red light ascend from anti-air emplacements up and down the coast. Dark, ruined ships appear, scuttled or destroyed, one with its bow shorn away, a second flickering as it burns. On an outermost island, panicked sheep run zigzagging between rocks. Inside each airplane, a bombardier peers through an aiming window and counts to 20. 4, 5, 6, 7. To the bombardiers, the walled city on its granite headland, drawing ever closer, looks like an unholy tooth, something black and dangerous, a final abscess to be lanced away. The girl. In a corner of the city, inside a tall, narrow house at number 4 Rue Vauberel, on the 6th and highest floor, a sightless 16-year-old named Marie-Laure LeBlanc kneels over a low table covered entirely with a model. The model is a miniature of the city she kneels within, and contains scale replicas of the hundreds of houses and shops and hotels within its walls. There's the cathedral with its perforated spire, and the bulky old Chateau de Saint-Malo, and row after row of seaside mansions studded with chimneys. A slender wooden jetty arcs out from a beach called the Plage du Mall. A delicate reticulated atrium vaults over the seafood market. Minute benches, the smallest no larger than apple seeds, dot the tiny public squares. Marie-Laure runs her fingertips along the centimeter-wide parapet crowning the ramparts, drawing an uneven star shape around the entire model. She finds the opening atop the walls where four ceremonial cannons point to sea. Bastion de la Hollande, she whispers, and her fingers walk down a little staircase. Rue des Cordiers, Rue Jacques Cartier. In a corner of the room stand two galvanized buckets filled to the rim with water. Fill them up, her great uncle has taught her, whenever you can. The bathtub on the third floor, too. Who knows when the water will go out again? Her fingers travel back to the cathedral spire, south to the gate of Dinan. All evening she has been marching her fingers around the model, waiting for her great uncle Etienne, who owns this house, who went out the previous night while she slept, and who has not returned. And now it is night again, another revolution of the clock, and the whole block is quiet, and she cannot sleep. She can hear the bombers when they are 3 miles away. A mounting static. The hum inside a seashell. When she opens the bedroom window, the noise of the airplanes becomes louder. Otherwise, the night is dreadfully silent. No engines, no voices, no clatter. No sirens. No footfalls on the cobbles. Not even gulls. Just a high tide 1 block away and 6 stories below, lapping at the base of the city walls. And something else. Something rattling softly. Very close. She eases open the left-hand shutter and runs her fingers up the slats of the right. A sheet of paper has lodged there. She holds it to her nose. It smells of fresh ink. Gasoline, maybe. The paper is crisp. It has not been outside long. Marie-Laure hesitates at the window in her stocking feet, her bedroom behind her, seashells arranged along the top of the armoire, pebbles along the baseboards. Her cane stands in the corner. Her big braille novel waits face down on the bed. The drone of the airplanes grows. The boy. 5 streets to the north, a white-haired 18-year-old German private named Werner Fennig wakes to a faint staccato hum. Little more than a purr. Flies tapping at a far-off windowpane. Where is he? The sweet, slightly chemical scent of gun oil. The raw wood of newly constructed shell crates. The mothballed odor of old bedspreads. He's in the hotel. Of course. L'Hôtel des Abeilles. The Hotel of Bees. Still night. Still early. From the direction of the sea come whistles and booms. Flak is going up. An anti-air corporal hurries down the corridor, heading for the stairwell. Get to the cellar, he calls over his shoulder. And Werner switches on his field light, rolls his blanket into his duffel, and starts down the hall. Not so long ago, the Hotel of Bees was a cheerful address, with bright blue shutters on its facade, and oysters on ice in its café, and Breton waiters in bow ties polishing glasses behind its bar. It offered 21 guest rooms, commanding sea views, and a lobby fireplace as big as a truck. Parisians on weekend holidays would drink aperitifs here, and before them the occasional emissary from the Republic. Ministers and vice ministers and abbots and admirals, and in the centuries before them, wind-burned corsairs, killers, plunderers, raiders, seamen. Before that, before it was ever a hotel at all, 5 full centuries ago it was the home of a wealthy privateer who gave up raiding ships to study bees in the pastures outside Saint-Malo, scribbling in notebooks and eating honey straight from the combs. The crests above the door lintels still have bumblebees carved into the oak. The ivy-covered fountain in the courtyard is shaped like a hive. Werner's favorites are 5 faded frescoes on the ceilings of the grandest upper rooms, where bees as big as children float against blue backdrops, big lazy drones and workers with diaphanous wings where, above a hexagonal bathtub, a single 9-foot-long queen with multiple eyes and a golden-furred abdomen curls across the ceiling. Over the past 4 weeks, the hotel has become something else. A fortress. A detachment of Austrian anti-airmen has boarded up every window, overturned every bed. They've reinforced the entrance, packed the stairwells with crates of artillery shells. The hotel's fourth floor, where garden rooms with French balconies open directly onto the ramparts, has become home to an aging high-velocity anti-air gun called an 88 that can fire 21.5-pound shells 9 miles. Her Majesty, the Austrians call their cannon. And for the past week, these men have tended to it the way worker bees might tend to a queen. They fed her oils, repainted her barrels, lubricated her wheels. They've arranged sandbags at her feet like offerings. The Royal Acht Acht, a deathly monarch meant to protect them all. Werner's in the stairwell, halfway to the ground floor, when the 88 fires twice in quick succession. It's the first time he's heard the gun at such close range, and it sounds as if the top half of the hotel has torn off. He stumbles and throws his arms over his ears. The walls reverberate all the way down to the foundation, then back up. Werner can hear Austrians 2 floors up scrambling, reloading, and receding screams of both shells as they hurtle above the ocean, already 2 or 3 miles away. One of the soldiers, he realizes, is singing. Or maybe it's more than one. Maybe they are all singing. 8 Luftwaffe men, none of whom will survive the hour, singing a love song to their queen. Werner chases the beam of his field light through the lobby. The big gun detonates a third time, and glass shatters somewhere close by, and torrents of soot rattle down the chimney, and the walls of the hotel toll like a struck bell. Werner worries that the sound will knock the teeth from his gums. He drags open the cellar door and pauses a moment, vision swimming. "This is it?" he asks. "They're really coming?" But who is there to answer? Saint-Malo. Up and down the lanes, the last unevacuated townspeople wake, groan, sigh. Spinsters, prostitutes, men over 60. Procrastinators, collaborators, disbelievers, drunks. Nuns of every order. The poor, the stubborn, the blind. Some hurry to bomb shelters. Some tell themselves it is merely a drill. Some linger to grab a blanket, or a prayer book, or a deck of playing cards. D-Day was 2 months ago. Cherbourg has been liberated. Caen liberated. Rennes, too. Half of western France is free. In the east, the Soviets have retaken Minsk. The Polish Home Army is revolting in Warsaw. A few newspapers have become bold enough to suggest that the tide has turned. But not here. Not this last citadel on the edge of the continent. This final German strong point on the Breton coast. Here, people whisper, the Germans have renovated 2 kilometers of subterranean corridors under the medieval walls. They have built new defenses, new conduits, new escape routes. Underground complexes of bewildering intricacy. Beneath the peninsular fort of La Cité, across the river from the old city, there are rooms of bandages, rooms of ammunition, even an underground hospital, or so it is believed. There is air conditioning. A 200,000-liter water tank, a direct line to Berlin. There are flame-throwing booby traps, a net of pillboxes with periscopic sights. They have stockpiled enough ordnance to spray shells into the sea all day, every day, for a year. "Here," they whisper, "are 1,000 Germans ready to die. Or 5,000. Maybe more." Saint-Malo. Water surrounds the city on 4 sides. Its link to the rest of France is tenuous, a causeway, a bridge, a spit of sand. We are Malouin first, say the people of Saint-Malo. Breton next. French, if there's anything left over. In stormy light, its granite glows blue. At the highest tides, the sea creeps into basements at the very center of town. At the lowest tides, the barnacled ribs of 1,000 shipwrecks stick out above the sea. For 3,000 years, this little promontory has known sieges. But never like this. A grandmother lifts a fussy toddler to her chest. A drunk, urinating in an alley outside Saint-Servin, a mile away, plucks a sheet of paper from a hedge. Urgent message to the inhabitants of this town, it says. Depart immediately to open country. Anti-air batteries flash on the outer islands, and the big German guns inside the old city send another round of shells howling over the sea, and 380 Frenchmen imprisoned on an island fortress called National, a quarter mile off the beach, huddle in a moonlit courtyard peering up. 4 years of occupation, and the roar of oncoming bombers is the roar of what? Deliverance? Extirpation? The clack-clack of small arms fire. The gravelly snare drums of flak. A dozen pigeons roosting on the cathedral spire cataract down its length and wheel out over the sea. Number 4, Rue Vauburel. Marie-Laure LeBlanc stands alone in her bedroom smelling a leaflet she cannot read. Sirens wail. She closes the shutters and relatches the window. Every second the airplanes draw closer. Every second is a second lost. She should be rushing downstairs. She should be making for the corner of the kitchen where a little trap door opens into a cellar full of dust and mouse-chewed rugs and ancient trunks long unopened. Instead, she returns to the table at the foot of the bed and kneels beside the model of the city. Again, her fingers find the outer ramparts, the Bastion de la Hollande, the little staircase leading down. In this window, right here in the real city, a woman beats her rug every Sunday. From this window here, a boy once yelled, "Watch where you're going! Are you blind?" The window panes rattle in their housings. The anti-air guns unleash another volley. The earth rotates just a bit farther. Beneath her fingertips, the miniature Rue d'Estrée intersects the miniature Rue Vauburel. Her fingers turn right. They skim doorways. 1, 2, 3, 4. How many times has she done this? Number 4. The tall, derelict bird's nest of a house owned by her great-uncle Etienne, where she has lived for 4 years, where she kneels on the 6th floor alone as 12 American bombers roar toward her. She presses inward on the tiny front door, and a hidden catch releases, and the little house lifts up and out of the model. In her hands, it's about the size of one of her father's cigarette boxes. Now the bombers are so close that the floor starts to throb under her knees. Out in the hall, the crystal pendants of the chandelier suspended above the stairwell chime. Marie-Laure twists the chimney of the miniature house 90 degrees. Then she slides off 3 wooden panels that make up its roof and turns it over. A stone drops into her palm. It's cold, the size of a pigeon's egg. The shape of a teardrop. Marie-Laure clutches the tiny house in one hand and the stone in the other. The room feels flimsy, tenuous. Giant fingertips seem about to punch through its walls. "Papa," she whispers. Cellar. Beneath the lobby of the Hotel of Bees, a corsair's cellar has been hacked out of the bedrock. Behind crates and cabinets and pegboards of tools, the walls are bare granite. 3 massive hand-hewn beams, hauled here from some ancient Breton forest, and craned into place centuries ago by teams of horses, hold up the ceiling. A single light bulb casts everything in a wavering shadow. Werner Fennig sits on a folding chair in front of a workbench, checks his battery level, and puts on headphones. The radio is a steel-cased two-way transceiver with a 1.6-meter band antenna. It enables him to communicate with a matching transceiver upstairs, with two other anti-air batteries inside the walls of the city, and with the underground garrison command across the river mouth. The transceiver hums as it warms. A spotter reads coordinates into the headpiece, and an artilleryman repeats them back. Werner rubs his eyes. Behind him, confiscated treasures are crammed to the ceiling. Rolled tapestries, grandfather clocks, armoires, the giant landscape paintings crazed with cracks. On a shelf opposite Werner sit 8 or 9 plaster heads, the purpose of which he cannot guess. The massive staff sergeant, Frank Folkheimer, comes down the narrow wooden stairs and ducks his head beneath the beams. He smiles gently at Werner and sits in a tall-backed armchair upholstered in golden silk with his rifle across his huge thighs, where it looks like little more than a baton. Werner says, "It's starting?" Folkheimer nods. He switches off his field light and blinks his strangely delicate eyelashes in the dimness. "How long will it last?" "Not long. We'll be safe down here." The engineer, Bernd, comes last. He is a little man with mousy hair and misaligned pupils. He closes the cellar door behind him and bars it, and sits halfway down the wooden staircase with a damp look on his face. Fear or grit? It's hard to say. With the door shut, the sound of the siren softens. Above them, the ceiling bulb flickers. "Water," thinks Werner. "I forgot water." A second anti-air battery fires from a distant corner of the city, and then the 88 upstairs goes again, stentorian, deadly, and Werner listens to the shell scream into the sky. Cascades of dust hiss out of the ceiling. Through his headphones, Werner can hear the Austrians upstairs still singing. Auf die Wälder, das scheint die Sonne a so gulde. Folkheimer picks sleepily at a stain on his trousers. Bernd blows into his cupped hands. The transceiver crackles with wind speeds, air pressure, trajectories. Werner thinks of home. Frau Elena, bent over his little shoes, double-knotting each lace. Stars wheeling past a dormer window. His little sister, Jutta, with a quilt around her shoulders, and a radio earpiece trailing from her left ear. 4 stories up, the Austrians clap another shell into the smoking breech of the 88, and double-check the traverse and clamp their ears as the gun discharges. But down here, Werner hears only the radio voices of his childhood. The goddess of history looked down to earth. Only through the hottest fires can purification be achieved. He sees a forest of dying sunflowers. He sees a flock of blackbirds explode out of a tree. Bombs away. 17, 18, 19, 20. Now the sea races beneath the aiming windows. Now rooftops. 2 smaller aircraft line the corridor with smoke, and the lead bomber salvos its payload, and 11 others follow suit. The bombs fall diagonally. The bombers rise and scramble. The underside of the sky goes black with flecks. Marie-Laure's great-uncle, locked with several hundred others inside the gates of Fort National, a quarter mile offshore, squints up and thinks, "Locusts." And an Old Testament proverb comes back to him from some cobwebbed hours of parish school. The locusts have no king, yet all of them go out in ranks. A demonic horde. Upended sacks of beans. 100 broken rosaries. There are 1,000 metaphors, and all of them are inadequate. 40 bombs per aircraft, 480 altogether. 72,000 pounds of explosives. An avalanche descends onto the city. A hurricane. Teacups drift off shelves. Paintings slip off nails. In another quarter second, the sirens are inaudible. Everything is inaudible. The roar becomes loud enough to separate membranes in the middle ear. The anti-air guns let fly their final shells. 12 bombers fold back unharmed into the blue night. On the 6th floor of number 4 Rue Vauburel, Marie-Laure crawls beneath her bed and clamps the stone and little model house to her chest. In the cellar beneath the Hotel of Bees, the single bulb in the ceiling winks out. Chapter 1, 1934. Muséum National d'Histoire Naturelle. Marie-Laure LeBlanc is a tall, freckled 6-year-old in Paris with rapidly deteriorating eyesight when her father sends her on a children's tour of the museum where he works. The guide is a hunchbacked old warder, hardly taller than a child himself. He raps the tip of his cane against the floor for attention, then leads his dozen charges across the gardens to the galleries. The children watch engineers use pulleys to lift a fossilized dinosaur femur. They see a stuffed giraffe in a closet, patches of hide wearing off its back. They peer into taxidermists' drawers full of feathers and talons and glass eyeballs. They flip through 200-year-old herbarium sheets bedecked with orchids and daisies and herbs. Eventually, they climb 16 steps into the gallery of mineralogy. The guide shows them agate from Brazil and violet amethysts, and a meteorite on a pedestal that he claims is as ancient as the solar system itself. Then he leads them single file down 2 twisting staircases and along several corridors, and stops outside an iron door with a single keyhole. "End of tour," he says. A girl says, "But what's through there?" "Behind this door is another locked door. Slightly smaller."
"And what's behind that?"
"A third locked door, smaller yet."
"What's behind that?"
"A fourth door, and a fifth, on and on until you reach a 13th. A little locked door no bigger than a shoe." The children lean forward.
"And then?"
"Behind the 13th door," the guide flourishes one of his impossibly wrinkled hands, "is the sea of flames." Puzzlement. Fidgeting. "Come now, you've never heard of the sea of flames?" The children shake their heads. Marie-Laure squints up at the naked bulbs strung in 3-yard intervals along the ceiling. Each sets a rainbow-colored halo rotating in her vision. The guide hangs his cane on his wrist and rubs his hands together. "It's a long story. Do you want to hear a long story?" They nod. He clears his throat. "Centuries ago, in the place we now call Borneo, a prince plucked a blue stone from a dry riverbed because he thought it was pretty. But on the way back to his palace, the prince was attacked by men on horseback and stabbed in the heart."
"Stabbed in the heart?
Is this true?" A boy says,
"Hush."
"The thieves stole his rings, his horse, everything. But because the little blue stone was clenched in his fist, they did not discover it, and the dying prince managed to crawl home. Then he fell unconscious for 10 days. On the 10th day, to the amazement of his nurses, he sat up, opened his hand, and there was the stone. The Sultan's doctors said it was a miracle, that the prince never should have survived such a violent wound. The nurses said the stone must have healing powers. The Sultan's jewelers said something else. They said the stone was the largest raw diamond anyone had ever seen. Their most gifted stone cutter spent 80 days faceting it, and when he was done, it was a brilliant blue, the blue of tropical seas. but it had a touch of red at its center, like flames inside a drop of water. The Sultan had the diamond fitted into a crown for the prince, and it was said that when the young prince sat on his throne and the sun hit him just so, he became so dazzling that visitors could not distinguish his figure from light itself. "Are you sure this is true?" asks a girl.
"Hush," says the boy.
The stone came to be known as the Sea of Flames. Some believed the prince was a deity, that as long as he kept the stone he could not be killed. But something strange began to happen. The longer the prince wore the crown, the worse his luck became. In a month he lost a brother to drowning, and a second brother to snake bite. Within 6 months his father died of disease. To make matters even worse, the Sultan's scouts announced that a great army was gathering to the east. The prince called together his father's advisors. All said he should prepare for war. All but one, a priest who said he'd had a dream. In the dream, the goddess of the earth told him that she'd made the Sea of Flames as a gift for her lover, the god of the sea, and was sending the jewel to him through the river. But when the river dried up and the prince plucked it out, the goddess became enraged. She cursed the stone and whoever kept it. Every child leans forward, Marie-Laure along with them. The curse was this. The keeper of the stone would live forever. But so long as he kept it, misfortunes would fall on all those he loved one after another in unending rain. Live forever? But if the keeper threw the diamond into the sea, thereby delivering it to its rightful recipient, the goddess would lift the curse. So the prince, now Sultan, thought for 3 days and 3 nights and finally decided to keep the stone. It had saved his life. He believed it made him indestructible. He had the tongue cut out of the priest's mouth.
"Ouch," says the youngest boy.
"Big mistake," says the tallest girl.
"The invaders came," says the warder, "and destroyed the palace and killed everyone they found, and the prince was never seen again. And for 200 years no one heard any more about the Sea of Flames. Some said the stone was recut into many smaller stones. Others said the prince still carried the stone, that he was in Japan or Persia, that he was a humble farmer, that he never seemed to grow old. And so the stone fell out of history, until one day when a French diamond trader, during a trip to the Golconda mines in India, was shown a massive pear-cut diamond, 133 carats, near perfect clarity, as big as a pigeon's egg, he wrote, and as blue as the sea, but with a flare of red at its core. He made a casting of the stone and sent it to a gem-crazy duke in Lorraine, warning him of the rumors of a curse. But the duke wanted the diamond very badly. So the trader brought it to Europe, and the duke fitted it into the end of a walking stick and carried it everywhere.
Uh-oh.
Within a month, the duchess contracted a throat disease. Two of their favorite servants fell off of the roof and broke their necks. Then the duke's only son died in a riding accident. Though everyone said the duke himself had never looked better, he became afraid to go out, afraid to accept visitors. Eventually, he was so convinced that his stone was the accursed Sea of Flames that he asked the king to shut it up in his museum on the conditions that it be locked deep inside a specially built vault and the vault not be opened for 200 years. And 196 years have passed. All the children remain quiet a moment. Several do math on their fingers. Then they raise their hands as one.
"Can we see it?"
"No."
"Not even open the first door?"
"No."
"Have you seen it?"
"I have not."
So how do you know it's really there?
You have to believe the story.
How much is it worth, monsieur? Could it buy the Eiffel Tower?
A diamond that large and rare could, in all likelihood, buy 5 Eiffel Towers. Gasps.
Are all those doors to keep thieves from getting in?
Maybe, the guide says and winks. They're there to keep the curse from getting out. The children fall quiet. 2 or 3 take a step back. Marie-Laure takes off her eyeglasses and the world goes shapeless.
Why not,
she asks, just take the diamond and throw it into the sea? The warder looks at her. The other children look at her.
When is the last time, one of the older boys says, you saw someone throw 5 Eiffel Towers into the sea?
There's laughter. Marie-Laure frowns. It is just an iron door with a brass keyhole. The tour ends and the children disperse, and Marie-Laure is reinstalled in the grand gallery with her father. He straightens her glasses on her nose and plucks a leaf from her hair.
Did you have fun, ma chérie?
A little brown house sparrow swoops out of the rafters and lands on the tiles in front of her. Marie-Laure holds out an open palm. The sparrow tilts his head, considering. Then it flaps away. 1 month later, she is blind.
Solverein. Werner Fennig grows up 300 miles northeast of Paris in a place called Solverein, a 4,000-acre coal mining complex outside Essen, Germany. It's steel country, anthracite country, a place full of holes. Smokestacks fume and locomotives trundle back and forth on elevated conduits, and leafless trees stand atop slag heaps like skeleton hands shoved up from the underworld. Werner and his younger sister, Jutta, are raised at Children's House, a clinker-brick two-story orphanage on Victoriastrasse, whose rooms are populated with the coughs of sick children, and the crying of newborns and battered trunks inside which drowse the last possessions of deceased parents. Patchwork dresses, tarnished wedding cutlery, faded amber types of fathers swallowed by the mines. Werner's earliest years are the leanest. Men brawl over jobs outside the Solverein gates, and chicken eggs sell for 2 million Reichsmarks apiece. And rheumatic fever stalks Children's House like a wolf. There is no butter or meat. Fruit is a memory. Some evenings, during the worst months, all the house directress has to feed her dozen wards are cakes made from mustard powder and water. But 7-year-old Werner seems to float. He is undersized and his ears stick out and he speaks with a high, sweet voice. The whiteness of his hair stops people in their tracks. Snowy, milky, chalky. A color that is the absence of color. Every morning he ties his shoes, packs newspapers inside his coat as insulation against the cold, and begins interrogating the world. He captures snowflakes, tadpoles, hibernating frogs. He coaxes bread from bakers with none to sell. He regularly appears in the kitchen with fresh milk for the babies. He makes things, too. Paper boxes, crude biplanes, toy boats with working rudders. Every couple of days, he'll startle the directress with some unanswerable query.
Why do we get hiccups, Frau Elena?
Or,
if the moon is so big, Frau Elena, how come it looks so little?
Or,
Frau Elena, does a bee know it's going to die if it stings somebody?
Frau Elena is a Protestant nun from Alsace who is more fond of children than of supervision. She sings French folk songs in a screechy falsetto, harbors a weakness for sherry, and regularly falls asleep standing up. Some nights she lets the children stay up late while she tells them stories in French about her girlhood cozied up against mountains, snow 6 feet deep on rooftops,
town criers and creeks smoking in the cold, and frost-dusted vineyards. A Christmas carol world.
Can deaf people hear their heartbeat, Frau Elena? Why doesn't glue stick to the inside of the bottle, Frau Elena?
She'll laugh. She'll tousle Werner's hair. She'll whisper, "They'll say you're too little, Werner. That you're from nowhere. That you shouldn't dream big. But I believe in you. I think you'll do something great."
Then she'll send him up to the little cot he has claimed for himself in the attic, pressed up beneath the window of a dormer. Sometimes he and Jutta draw. His sister sneaks up to Werner's cot, and together they lie on their stomachs and pass a single pencil back and forth. Jutta, though she is 2 years younger, is the gifted one. She loves most of all to draw Paris, a city she has seen in exactly one photograph, on the back cover of one of Frau Elena's romance novels. Mansard roofs, hazy apartment blocks, the iron lattice of a distant tower. She draws twisting white skyscrapers, complicated bridges, flocks of figures beside a river. Other days, in the hours after lessons, Werner tows his little sister through the mine complex in a wagon he has assembled from cast-off parts. They rattle down the long gravel lanes, past pit cottages and trash-barrel fires, past laid-off miners squatting all day on upturned crates, motionless as statues. One wheel regularly clunks off, and Werner crouches patiently beside it, threading back the bolts. All around them, the figures of second-shift workers shuffle into warehouses while first-shift workers shuffle home, hunched, hungry, blue-nosed, their faces like black skulls beneath their helmets.
"Hello," Werner will chirp. "Good afternoon."
But the miners usually hobble past without replying, perhaps without even seeing him, their eyes on the muck, the economic collapse of Germany looming over them like the severe geometry of the mills. Werner and Jutta sift through glistening piles of black dust. They clamber up mountains of rusting machines. They tear berries out of brambles and dandelions out of fields. Sometimes they manage to find potato peels or carrot greens in the trash bins. Other afternoons they collect paper to draw on, or old toothpaste tubes from which the last dregs can be squeezed out and dried into chalk. Once in a while, Werner tows Jutta as far as the entrance to Pit 9, the largest of the mines, wrapped in noise, lit like the pilot at the center of a gas furnace. A 5-story coal elevator crouched over it, cables swinging, hammers banging, men shouting, an entire map full of pleated and corrugated industry stretching into the distance on all sides, and they watch the coal cars trundling up from the earth and the miners spilling out of the warehouses with their lunch pails toward the mouth of the elevator, like insects toward a lighted trap.
"Down there," Werner whispers to his sister, "that's where Father died."
And as night falls, Werner pulls little Jutta wordlessly back through the close-set neighborhoods of Solverein, two snowy-haired children in a bottomland of soot, bearing their paltry treasures to Victoriastrasse 3, where Frau Elena stares into the coal stove, singing a French lullaby in a tired voice, one toddler yanking her apron strings, while another howls in her arms. Key pound. Congenital cataracts. Bilateral. Irreparable. "Can you see this?" asks the doctors. "Can you see this?" Marie-Laure will not see anything for the rest of her life. Spaces she once knew as familiar, the 4-room flat she shares with her father, the little tree-lined square at the end of their street, have become labyrinths bristling with hazards. Drawers are never where they should be. The toilet is an abyss. A glass of water is too near, too far. Her fingers too big, always too big. What is blindness? Where there should be a wall, her hands find nothing. Where there should be nothing, a table leg gouges her shin.
Cars growl in the streets. Leaves whisper in the sky. Blood rustles through her inner ears. In the stairwell, in the kitchen, even beside her bed, grown-up voices speak of despair. Poor child. Poor Monsieur LeBlanc. Hasn't had an easy road, you know. His father dead in the war, his wife dead in childbirth, and now this? Like they're cursed. Look at her. Look at him. He ought to send her away. Those are months of bruises and wretchedness. Rooms pitching like sailboats, half-open doors striking Marie-Laure's face. Her only sanctuary is in bed, the hem of her quilt at her chin, while her father smokes another cigarette in the chair beside her, whittling away at one of his tiny models, his little hammer going tap, 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 his little square of sandpaper making a rhythmic, soothing rasp. The despair doesn't last. Marie-Laure is too young and her father is too patient. There are, he assures her, no such things as curses. There is luck, maybe, bad or good. A slight inclination of each day toward success or failure, but no curses. 6 mornings a week he wakes her before dawn, and she holds her arms in the air while he dresses her. Stockings, dress, sweater. If there's time, he makes her try to knot her shoes herself. Then they drink a cup of coffee together in the kitchen. Hot, strong, as much sugar as she wants. At 6:40, she collects her white cane from the corner, loops a finger through the back of her father's belt, and follows him down 3 flights and up 6 blocks to the museum. He unlocks entrance number 2 at 7 sharp. Inside are the familiar smells. Typewriter ribbons, waxed floors, rock dust. There are the familiar echoes of their footfalls crossing the Grand Gallery. He greets a night guard, then a warder. Always the same 2 words repeated back. Bonjour, bonjour. 2 lefts, 1 right. Her father's key ring jingles. A lock gives way. A gate swings open. Inside the key pound, inside 6 glass-fronted cabinets, thousands of iron keys hang from the pegs. There are blanks and skeletons, barrel-stem keys and Saturn bow keys, elevator keys and cabinet keys as long as Marie-Laure's forearm, and keys shorter than her thumb. Marie-Laure's father is principal locksmith for the National Museum of Natural History. Between the laboratories, warehouses, 4 separate public museums, the menagerie, the greenhouses, the acres of medicinal and decorative gardens in the Jardin des Plantes, and 12 gates and pavilions, her father estimates there are 12,000 locks in the entire museum complex. No one else knows enough to disagree. All morning he stands at the front of the key pound and distributes keys to employees. Zookeepers coming first. Office staff arriving in a rush around 8. Technicians and librarians and scientific assistants trooping in next. Scientists trickling in last. Everything is numbered and color-coded. Every employee from custodians to the director must carry his or her keys at all time. No one is allowed to leave his respective building with keys. And no one is allowed to leave keys on a desk. The museum possesses priceless jade from the 13th century, after all, and canvasite from India, and rhodochrosite from Colorado. Behind a lock her father has designed sits a Florentine dispensary bowl carved from lapis lazuli that specialists travel 1,000 miles every year to examine. Her father quizzes her. Vault key or padlock key, Marie? Cupboard key or deadbolt key? He tests her on the locations of displays, on the contents of cabinets. He is continually placing some unexpected thing into her hands. A light bulb, a fossilized fish, a flamingo feather. For 1 hour each morning, even Sundays, he makes her sit over a Braille workbook. A is 1 dot in the upper corner. B is 2 dots in a vertical line. Jean goes
to the baker. Jean goes to the cheese maker.
In the afternoons, he takes her on his rounds. He oils latches, repairs cabinets, polishes escutcheons. He leads her down hallway after hallway into gallery after gallery. Narrow corridors open into immense libraries. Glass doors give way to hot houses overflowing with the smells of humus, wet newspaper, and lobelia. There are carpenter's shops, taxidermist's studios, acres of shelves and specimen drawers, whole museums within the museum. Some afternoons he leaves Marie-Laure in the laboratory of Dr. Geffard, an aging mollusk expert whose beard smells permanently of damp wool. Dr. Geffard will stop whatever he is doing and open a bottle of Malbec and tell Marie-Laure in his whispery voice about the reefs he visited as a young man. The Seychelles, Belize, Zanzibar. He calls her Laurette. He eats a roasted duck every day at 3 p.m. His mind accommodates a seemingly inexhaustible catalog of Latin binomial names. On the back wall of Dr. Geffard's lab are cabinets that contain more drawers than she can count, and he lets her open them one after another and holds seashells in her hands. Whelks, olives, imperial volutes from Thailand, spider conchs from Polynesia. The museum possesses more than 10,000 specimens, over half the known species in the world, and Marie-Laure gets to handle most of them. Now that shell, Laurette, belonged to a violet sea snail, a blind snail that lives its whole life on the surface of the sea. As soon as it is released into the ocean, it agitates the water to make bubbles and binds those bubbles with mucus and builds a raft. Then it blows around, feeding on whatever floating aquatic invertebrates it encounters. But if it ever loses its raft, it will sink and die. A carinaria shell is simultaneously light and heavy, hard and soft, smooth and rough. The Murex Dr. Geffard keeps on his desk can entertain her for a half hour. The hollow spines, the ridged whorls, the deep entrance. It's a forest of spikes and caves and textures. It's a kingdom. Her hands move ceaselessly, gathering, probing, testing. The breast feathers of a stuffed and mounted chickadee are impossibly soft. Its beak as sharp as a needle. The pollen at the tips of tulip anthers is not so much powder as it is tiny balls of oil. To really touch something, she is learning, the bark of a sycamore tree in the gardens, a pinned stag beetle in the Department of Entomology, the exquisitely polished interior of a scallop shell in Dr. Geffard's workshop, is to love it. At home in the evenings, her father stows their shoes in the same cubby, hangs their coats on the same hooks. Marie-Laure crosses 6 evenly spaced friction strips on the kitchen tiles to reach the table. She follows a strand of twine he has threaded from the table to the toilet. He serves dinner on a round plate and describes the locations of different foods by the hands of a clock. Potatoes at 6 o'clock, ma chérie. Mushrooms at 3. Then he lights a cigarette and goes to work on his miniatures at a workbench in the corner of the kitchen. He is building a scale model of their entire neighborhood. The tall windowed houses, the rain gutters, the laverie and boulangerie, and the little place at the end of the street with its 4 benches and 10 trees. On warm nights, Marie-Laure opens her bedroom window and listens to the evening as it settles over the balconies and gables and chimneys, languid and peaceful, until the real neighborhood and the miniature one get mixed up in her mind. Tuesdays, the museum is closed. Marie-Laure and her father sleep in. They drink coffee thick with sugar. They walk to the Pantheon, or to a flower market, or along the Seine. Every so often they visit the bookshop. He hands her a dictionary, a journal, a magazine full of photographs. How many pages, Marie-Laure? She runs a nail along the edge. 52?
705? 139?
He sweeps her hair back from her ears. He swings her above his head. He says she is his émerveillement. He says he will never leave her. Not in a million years. Radio. Werner is 8 years old and ferreting about in the refuse behind a storage shed when he discovers what looks like a large spool of thread. It consists of a wire-wrapped cylinder sandwiched between two discs of pine wood. Three frayed electrical leads sprout from the top. One has a small earphone dangling from its end. Jutta, 6 years old, with a round face and a mashed cumulus of white hair, crouches beside her brother.
What is that?
I think, Werner says, feeling as though some cupboard in the sky has just opened.
We just found a radio.
Until now, he has seen radios only in glimpses. A big cabinet wireless through the lace curtains of an official's house. A portable unit in a miner's dormitory. Another in the church refectory. He has never touched one. He and Jutta smuggle the device back to Victoriastrasse 3 and appraise it beneath an electric lamp. They wipe it clean, untangle the snarl of wires, wash mud out of the earphone. It does not work. Other children come and stand over them and marvel, then gradually lose interest and conclude it is hopeless. But Werner carries the receiver up to his attic dormer and studies it for hours. He disconnects everything that will disconnect. He lays its parts out on the floor and holds them one by one to the light. 3 weeks after finding the device on a sun-gilded afternoon, when perhaps every other child in Solverein is outdoors, he notices that the longest wire, a slender filament coiled hundreds of times around the central cylinder, has several small breaks in it. Slowly, meticulously, he unwraps the coil, carries the entire looped mess downstairs, and calls Jutta inside to hold the pieces for him while he splices the breaks. Then he rewraps it.
Now let's try, he whispers, and presses the earphone against his ear, and runs what he has decided must be the tuning pin back and forth along the coil. He hears a fizz of static. Then, from somewhere deep inside the earpiece, a stream of consonants issues forth. Werner's heart pauses. The voice seems to echo in the architecture of his head. The sound fades as quickly as it came. He shifts the pin a quarter inch. More static. Another quarter inch. Nothing.
In the kitchen, Frau Elena kneads bread. Boys shout in the alley. Werner guides the tuning pin back and forth. Static. Static. He is about to hand the earphone to Jutta when, clear and unblemished, about halfway down the coil, he hears the quick, drastic strikes of a bow dashing across the strings of a violin. He tries to hold the pin perfectly still. A second violin joins the first. Jutta drags herself closer. She watches her brother with outsized eyes. A piano chases the violins. Then woodwinds. The strings sprint, woodwinds fluttering behind. More instruments join in. Flutes? Harps? The song races, seems to loop back over itself.
Werner? Jutta whispers.
He blinks.
He has to swallow back tears.
The parlor looks the same as it always has. Two cribs beneath two Latin crosses. Dust floating in the open mouth of the stove. A dozen layers of paint peeling off the baseboards. A needlepoint of Frau Elena's snowy Alsatian village above the sink. Yet now there is music. As if, inside Werner's head, an infinitesimal orchestra has stirred to life. The room seems to fall into a slow spin. His sister says his name more urgently, and he presses the earphone to his sister's ear.
Music, she says.
He holds the pin as stock still as he can. The signal is weak enough that, though the earphone is 6 inches away, he can't hear any trace of the song. But he watches his sister's face, motionless except for her eyelids,